see Julie's mother-in-law, and as usual, the old bitch would spoil Danny rotten, and Danny didn't have far to go.
I want to go see him.
No, Danny.
I want to see if he's sick.
No.
Yeah, but what if he's dying, Ma?
Danny's eyes positively glowed at this entrancing possibility.
He might be dying right now.
Danny, shut up.
Hey, mister, Danny cried. You dying or anything?
Danny, you shut your mouth, Julie hissed, her cheeks burning with embarrassment.
Danny began to cry then. Not real crying, but that snotty, I can't get my own way whining that always made her want to grab him and pinch his arms until he really had something to cry about. At times like this, riding the bus into evening through another cruddy snowstorm with her son whining beside her, she wished her own mother had sterilized her several years before she had reached the age of consent. That was when the man across the aisle turned his head and smiled at her. A tired, painful smile, but rather sweet for all that. She saw that his eyes were terribly bloodshot, as if he had been crying. She tried to smile back, but it felt false and uneasy on her lips. That red left eye and the scar running up his neck made that half of his face look sinister and unpleasant. She hoped that the man across the aisle wasn't going all the way to Portsmouth, but as it turned out, he was. She caught sight of him in the terminal as Danny's gram swept the boy, giggling happily, into her arms. She saw him limping toward the terminal doors, a scuffed traveling bag in one hand, a new attaché case in the other. And for just a moment, she felt a terrible chill cross her back. It was really worse than a limp. It was very nearly a headlong lurch. But there was something implacable about it, she told the New Hampshire State Police later. It was as if he knew exactly where he was going, and nothing was going to stop him from getting there. Then he passed out into the darkness, and she lost sight of him.
7.
Timsdale, New Hampshire, is a small town west of Durham, just inside the 3rd Congressional District. It is kept alive by the smallest of the Chatsworth Mills, which hulks like a soot-stained brick ogre on the edge of Timsdale Stream. Its one modest claim to fame, according to the local Chamber of Commerce, is that it was the first town in New Hampshire to have electric streetlights. One evening in early January, a young man with prematurely graying hair and a limp walked into the Timsdale Pub, the town's only beer joint. Dick O'Donnell, the owner, was tending the bar. The place was almost empty because it was the middle of the week, and another norther was brewing. 2 or 3 inches had piled up out there already, and more was on the way. The man with the limp stamped off his shoes, came to the bar, and ordered a Pabst. O'Donnell served him. The fellow had 2 more, making them last, watching the TV over the bar. The color was going bad, had been for a couple months now, and the Fonz looked like an aging Romanian ghoul. O'Donnell couldn't remember having seen this guy around.
"Like another?" O'Donnell asked, coming back to the bar after serving the 2 old bags in the corner.
"One more won't hurt," the fellow said. He pointed to a spot above the TV.
"You met him, I guess."
It was a framed blow-up of a political cartoon. It showed Greg Stilson, his construction helmet cocked back on his head, throwing a fellow in a business suit down the Capitol steps. The fellow in the business suit was Louis Quinn, the congressman who had been caught taking kickbacks in the parking lot scam some 14 months ago. The cartoon was titled, "Giving 'em the Bum's Rush," and across the corner, it had been signed in a scrawling hand.
"For Dick O'Donnell, who keeps the best damn saloon in the 3rd District. Keep drawing them, Dick. Greg Stilson."
"Bet your butt I did," O'Donnell said. "He gave a speech in here the last time he canvassed for the House. Had signs out all over town. Come on into the pub at 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon and have one on Greg. That was the best damn day's business I ever done. People was only supposed to have one on him, but he ended up grabbing the whole tab. Can't do much better than that, can you?"
"Sounds like you think he's one hell of a guy."
"Yeah, I do," O'Donnell said. "I'd be tempted to put my bare knuckles on anyone who said the other way."
Well, I won't try you. The fellow put down 3/4. Have one on me.
Well, okay. Don't mind if I do.
Thanks, Mr.
Johnny Smith is my name.
Why, pleased to meet you, Johnny.
Dickie O'Donnell, that's me.
He drew himself a beer from the tap.
Yeah, Greg's done this part of New Hampshire a lot of good. And there's a lot of people afraid to come right out and say it, but I'm not. I'll say it right out loud. Someday Greg Stilson's apt to be president.
You think so?
I do, O'Donnell said, coming back to the bar. New Hampshire's not big enough to hold Greg. He's one hell of a politician, and coming for me, that's something. I thought the whole crew was nothing but a bunch of crooks and lollygags. I still do. But Greg's an exception to the rule. He's a square shooter. If you told me 5 years ago I'd be saying something like that, I would have laughed in your face. You'd be more likely to find me reading poetry than seeing any good in a politician, I would have said. But God damn it, he's a man.
Johnny said, most of these guys want to be your buddy while they're running for office. But when they get in, it's fuck you, Jack. I got mine until the next election. I come from Maine myself. And the one time I wrote Ed Muskie, you know what I got? A form letter.
Oh, that's a Polack for you, O'Donnell said. What do you expect from a Polack?
Listen, Greg comes back to the district every damn weekend. Now, does that sound like fuck you, Jack? I got mine to you?
Every weekend, huh?
Johnny sipped his beer.
Where?
Trimble? Ridgeway? The big towns?
He's got a system, O'Donnell said in the reverent tones of a man who has never quite been able to work one out for himself. 15 towns from the big places like Capital City right down to the little burgs like Timsdale and Quarters Notch. He hits one a week until he's gone through the whole list, and then he starts at the top again. You know how big Quarters Notch is? They got 800 souls up there. So what do you think about a guy who takes a weekend off from Washington and comes down to Quarters Notch to freeze his balls off in a cold meeting hall? Does that sound like fuck you, Jack, I got mine to you?
No, it doesn't, Johnny said truthfully.
What does he do? Just shake hands?
No. He's got a hall in every town, reserves it for all day Saturday. He gets in there about 10 in the morning, and people can come by and talk to him. Tell him their ideas, you know. If they got questions, he answers them. If he can't answer them, he goes back to Washington and finds the answer.
He looked at Johnny triumphantly.
When was he here in Timsdale last?
A couple of months ago, O'Donnell said.
He went to the cash register and rummaged through a pile of papers beside it. He came up with a dog-eared clipping and laid it on the bar beside Johnny.
Here's the list. You just take a look at that and see what you think.
The clipping was from the Ridgeway paper. It was fairly old now. The story was headlined, Stilson Announces Feedback Centers. The first paragraph looked as though it might have been lifted straight from the Stilson press kit. Below it was the list of towns where Greg would be spending his weekends and the proposed dates. He was not due in Timsdale again until mid-March.
I think it looks pretty good, Johnny said.
Yeah, I think so. A lot of people think so.
By this clipping, you must have been in Quarters Notch just last weekend.
That's right, O'Donnell said and laughed.
Good old Quarters Notch. Want another beer, Johnny?
Only if you join me, Johnny said, and laid a couple of bucks on the bar.
Well, I don't care if I do.
One of the two bar bags had put some money in the juke, and Tammy Wynette, sounding old and tired and not happy to be here, began singing, Stand By Your Man.
Hey, Dick, the other cawed. You ever hear of service in this place?
Shut your head, he hollered back.
Fuck you, she called and cackled. God damn it, Clarice, I told you about saying the F word in my bar. I told you. Oh, get off it and let's have some beer.
I hate those two old cunts, O'Donnell muttered to Johnny. Couple of old alky diesel dykes, that's what they are. They've been here a million years, and I wouldn't be surprised if they both lived to spit on my grave. It's a hell of a world sometimes.
Yes, it is.
Pardon me, I'll be right back. I got a girl, but she only comes in Fridays and Saturdays in the winter. O'Donnell drew 2 schooners of beer and brought them over to the table. He said something to them, and Clarice replied,
Fuck
you,
and cackled again. The beer joint was filled with the ghosts of dead hamburgers. Tammy Wynette sang through the popcorn crackle of an old record. The radiators studded dull heat into the room, and outside snow spatted dryly against the glass. Johnny rubbed his temples. He had been in this bar before, in 100 other small towns. His head ached. When he had shaken O'Donnell's hand, he knew that the barkeep had a big old mongrel dog that he had trained to sic on command. His one great dream was that some night a burglar would break into his house, and he would legally be able to sic that big old dog onto him, and there would be one less goddamn hippie pervo junkie in the world. Oh, his head ached. O'Donnell came back, wiping his hands on his apron. Tammy Wynette finished up and was replaced with Red Sauvant, who had a CB call for the teddy bear.
Thanks again for the suds, O'Donnell said, drawing two.
My pleasure, Johnny said, still studying the clipping. Quarters notch last week, Jackson this coming weekend. Never heard of that one. Must be a pretty small town, huh?
Just a burg, O'Donnell agreed. They used to have a ski resort, but it went broke. A lot of unemployment up that way. They do some wood pulping and a little shirt-tail farming. But he goes up there by the Jesus, talks to him, listens to their bitches. Where are you from up in Maine, Johnny?
Lewiston, Johnny lied. The clipping said that Greg Stilson would meet with interested persons at the town hall.
Guess you came down for the skiing, huh?
No, I hurt my leg a while back. I don't ski anymore. Just passing through. Thanks for letting me look at this. Johnny handed the clipping back. It's quite interesting. O'Donnell put it carefully back with his other papers. He had an empty bar, a dog back home that would sic on command, and Greg Stilson. Greg had been in his bar. Johnny found himself abruptly wishing himself dead. If this talent was a gift from God, then God was a dangerous lunatic who ought to be stopped. If God wanted Greg Stilson dead, why hadn't he sent him down the birth canal with the umbilical cord wrapped around his throat? Or strangled him on a piece of meat? Or electrocuted him while he was changing the radio station? Drowned him in the old swimming hole? Why did God have to have Johnny Smith to do his dirty work? It wasn't his responsibility to save the world. That was for the psychos, and only psychos would presume to try it. He suddenly decided he would let Greg Stilson live and spit in God's eye.
You okay, Johnny? O'Donnell asked.
Huh? Yeah, sure.
You looked sort of funny for just a second there.
Chuck Chatsworth saying, if I didn't, I'd be afraid all those people he killed would haunt me to my grave.
Out wool gathering, I guess, Johnny said. I want you to know it's been a pleasure drinking with you.
Well, the same goes back to you, O'Donnell said, looking pleased. I wish more people passing through felt that way. They go through here headed for the ski resorts, you know, the big places. That's where they take their money. If I thought they'd stop in, I'd fix this place up like they'd like. Posters, you know, of Switzerland and Colorado. A fireplace. Load the juke up with rock and roll records instead of that shit-kicking music. I'd like that. He shrugged. I'm not a bad guy. Hell.
Of course not, Johnny said, getting off the stool and thinking about the dog trained to sic and the hoped-for hippie junkie burglar.
Well, tell your friends I'm here, O'Donnell said.
For sure, Johnny said.
Hey, Dick, one of the bar bags hollered. Ever hear of service with a smile in this place?
Why don't you get stuffed? O'Donnell yelled at her, flushing.
Fuck you! Clarice called back and cackled.
Johnny slipped quietly out into the gathering storm.
8. He was staying at the Holiday Inn in Portsmouth. When he got back that evening, he told the desk clerk to have his bill ready for checkout in the morning. In his room, he sat down at the impersonal Holiday Inn writing desk, took out all the stationery, and grasped the Holiday Inn pen. His head was throbbing, but there were letters to be written. His momentary rebellion, if that's what it had been, had passed. His unfinished business with Greg Stilson remained. I've gone crazy, he thought. That's really it. I've gone entirely off my chump. He could see the headlines now. Psycho shoots New Hampshire rep. Madman assassinates Stilson. Hail of bullets cuts down U.S. representative in New Hampshire. An inside view, of course, would have a field day. Self-proclaimed seer kills Stilson. 12 noted psychiatrists tell why Smith did it. With a sidebar by that fellow Dees, maybe, telling how Johnny had threatened to get his shotgun and shoot me a trespasser. Crazy. The hospital debt was paid, but this would leave a new bill of particulars behind, and his father would have to pay for it. He and his new wife would spend a lot of days in the limelight of his reflected notoriety. They would get the hate mail. Everyone he had known would be interviewed. The Chatsworths, Sam, Sheriff George Bannerman. Sarah? Well, maybe they wouldn't get as far as Sarah. After all, it wasn't as though he were planning to shoot the president. At least not yet. There's a lot of people afraid to come right out and say it, but I'm not. I'll say it right out loud. Someday, Greg Stilson's apt to be president. Johnny rubbed his temples. The headache came in low, slow waves, and none of this was getting his letters written. He drew the first sheet of stationery toward him, picked up the pen, and wrote, Dear Dad. Outside, snow struck the window with that dry, sandy sound that means serious business. Finally, the pen began to move across the paper, slowly at first, then gaining speed. Chapter 27 1 Johnny came up wooden steps that had been shoveled clear of snow and salted down. He went through a set of double doors and into a foyer plastered with specimen ballots and notices of a special town meeting to be held here in Jackson on the 3rd of February. There was also a notice of Greg Stilson's impending visit and a picture of the man who himself, hard hat cocked back on his head, grinning that hard, slantwise, we're wise to him, ain't we, pard, grin. Set a little to the right of the green door, leading into the meeting hall itself, was a sign that Johnny hadn't expected, and he pondered it in silence for several seconds, his breath pluming white from his lips. Driver examinations today, this sign read. It was on a wooden easel. Have papers ready. He opened the door, went into the stuporous glow of heat thrown by a big wood stove, and there sat a cop at a desk. The cop was wearing a ski parka unzipped. There were papers scattered across his desk, and there was also a gadget for examining visual acuity. The cop looked up at Johnny, and he felt a sinking sensation in his gut. Can I help you, sir? Johnny fingered the camera slung around his neck. Well, I wondered if it would be all right to look around a little bit, he said. I'm on assignment from Yankee Magazine. We're doing a spread on town hall architecture in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. Taking a lot of pictures, you know. Go right to it, the cop said. My wife reads Yankee all the time. Puts me to sleep. Johnny smiled. New England architecture has a tendency toward, well, starkness. Starkness, the cop repeated doubtfully, and then let it go. Next, please. A young man approached the desk the cop was sitting behind. He handed an examination sheet to the cop, who took it and said, Look into the viewer, please, and identify the traffic signs and signals, which I will show you. A young man peered into the viewing machine. The cop put an answer key over the young man's exam sheet. Johnny moved down the center aisle of the Jackson Town Hall and clicked a picture of the rostrum at the front. Stop sign, the young man said from behind him. The next one's a yield sign, and the next one is a traffic information sign. No right turn, no left turn, like that. He hadn't expected a cop in the town hall. He hadn't even bothered to buy film for the camera he was using as a prop. But now it was too late to back out anyway. This was Friday, and Stilson would be here tomorrow if things went the way they were supposed to go. He would be answering questions and listening to suggestions from the good people of Jackson. There would be a fair-sized entourage with him, a couple of aides, a couple of advisors, and several others, young men in sober suits and sports jackets, who had been wearing jeans and riding motorcycles not so long ago. Greg Stilson was still a firm believer in guards for the body. At the Trimble rally, they had been carrying sawed-off pool cues. Did they carry guns now? Would it be so difficult for a U.S. representative to get a permit to carry a concealed weapon? Johnny didn't think so. He could count on one good chance only. He would have to make the most of it. So it was important to look the place over, to try and decide if he could take Stilson in here, or if it would be better to wait in the parking lot with the window rolled down and the rifle on his lap. So he had come, and here he was, casing the joint, while a state cop gave driver permit exams not 30 feet away. There was a bulletin board on his left, and Johnny snapped his unloaded camera at it. Why in God's name hadn't he taken another 2 minutes and bought himself a roll of film? The board was covered with chatty small-town intelligence concerning baked bean suppers, an upcoming high school play, dog licensing information, and of course, more on Greg. A file card said that Jackson's first selectman was looking for someone who could take shorthand, and Johnny studied this as though it were of great interest to him, while his mind moved into high gear. Of course, if Jackson looked impossible, or even chancy, he could wait until next week, where Stilson would be doing the whole thing all over again in the town of Upson, or the week after in Trimble, or the week after that, or never. It should be this week. It ought to be tomorrow. He snapped the big wood stove in the corner and then glanced upward. There was a balcony up there. No, not precisely a balcony. More like a gallery with a waist-high railing and wide, white-painted slats with small decorative diamonds and curlicues cut into the wood. It would be very possible for a man to crouch behind the railing and look through one of those doodads. At the right moment, he could just stand up and...
What kind of camera is that?
Johnny looked around, sure it was the cop. The cop would ask to see his filmless camera, and then he would want to see some ID, and then it would be all over. But it wasn't the cop. It was the young man who had been taking his driver's permit test. He was about 22, with long hair and pleasant, frank eyes. He was wearing a suede coat and faded jeans.
A Nikon, Johnny said. Good camera, man. I'm a real camera nut. How long have you been working for Yankee?
Well, I'm freelance, Johnny said. I do stuff for them, sometimes for Country Journal, sometimes for Down East, you know.
Nothing national, like People or Life?
No, at least not yet.
What f-stop do you use in here?
What the hell is an f-stop? Johnny shrugged.
I play it mostly by ear.
By eye, you mean, the young man said, smiling.
That's right, by eye.
Get lost, kid. Please get lost.
I'm interested in freelancing myself, the young man said and grinned. My big dream is to take a picture someday like the flag raising at Iwo Jima.
I heard that was staged, Johnny said.
Well, maybe. Maybe. But it's a classic. Or how about the first picture of a UFO coming in for a landing? I'd sure like that. Anyway, I've got a portfolio of stuff I've taken around here. Who's your contact at Yankee?
Johnny was sweating now.
Actually, they contacted me on this one, he said. It was a...
Mr. Clausen, you can come over now, the cop said, sounding impatient. I'd like to go over these answers with you.
Whoops, his master's voice, Clausen said. See you later, man.
He hurried off, and Johnny let out his breath in a silent, whispering sigh. It was time to get out, and quickly. He snapped another 2 or 3 pictures, just so it wouldn't look like a complete rout, but he was barely aware of what he was looking at through the viewfinder. Then he left. The young man in the suede jacket, Clausen, had forgotten all about him. He'd apparently flunked the written part of his exam. He was arguing strenuously with the cop, who was only shaking his head. Johnny paused for a moment in the town hall's entryway. To his left was a cloakroom. To his right was a closed door. He tried it and found it unlocked. A narrow flight of stairs led upward into dimness. The actual offices would be up there, of course. And the gallery. 2. He was staying at the Jackson House, a pleasant little hotel on the main drag. It had been carefully renovated, and the renovations had probably cost a lot of money. But the place would pay for itself, the owners must have reckoned, because of the new Jackson Mountain ski resort. Only the resort had gone bust, and now the pleasant little hotel was barely hanging on. The night clerk was dozing over a cup of coffee when Johnny went out at 4 o'clock on Saturday morning, the attaché case in his left hand. He had slept little last night, slipping into a short, light doze after midnight. He had dreamed. It was 1970 again. It was carnival time. He and Sarah stood in front of the Wheel of Fortune, and again he had that feeling of crazy, enormous power. In his nostrils, he could smell burning rubber.
"Come on," a voice said softly behind him. "I'd love to watch this guy take a beating."
He turned, and it was Frank Dodd, dressed in his black vinyl raincoat, his throat slit from ear to ear in a wide red grin. His eyes sparkled with dead vivaciousness. He turned back to the booth, scared. But now the pitchman was Greg Stilson, grinning knowingly at him, his yellow hard hat tipped cockily back on his skull.
"Hey, hey, hey," Stilson chanted, his voice deep and resonant and ominous. "Lay 'em down where you want 'em down, fella. What do you say? Want to shoot the moon?"
Yes, he wanted to shoot the moon. But as Stilson set the wheel in motion, he saw that the entire outer circle had turned green. Every number was 00. Every number was a house number. He jerked awake and spent the rest of the night looking out the frost-rimmed window into darkness. The headache he'd had ever since arriving in Jackson the day before was gone, leaving him feeling weak but composed. He sat with his hands in his lap. He didn't think about Greg Stilson. He thought about the past. He thought about his mother putting a Band-Aid on a scraped knee. He thought about the time the dog had torn off the back of Grandma Nellie's absurd sundress and how he had laughed, and how Vera had swatted him one and cut his forehead with the stone of her engagement ring. He thought about his father showing him how to bait a fishing hook and saying, "It doesn't hurt the worms, Johnny. At least I don't think it does." He thought about his father giving him a pocket knife for Christmas when he was 7 and saying very seriously, "I'm trusting you, Johnny." All those memories had come back in a flood. Now he stepped off into the deep cold of the morning, his shoes squeaking on the path shoveled through the snow. His breath plumed out in front of him. The moon was down, but the stars were sprawled across the black sky in idiot's profusion.
"God's jewel box," Vera always called it. "You're looking into God's jewel box, Johnny."
He walked down Main Street, and he stopped in front of the tiny Jackson post office and fumbled the letters out of his coat pocket. Letters to his father, to Sarah, to Sam Wyzak, to Bannerman. He set the attaché case down between his feet, opened the mailbox that stood in front of the neat little brick building, and after one brief moment of hesitation, dropped them in. He could hear them drop down inside, surely the first letters mailed in Jackson this new day, and the sound gave him a queer sense of finality. The letters were mailed. There was no stopping now. He picked up the case again and walked on. The only sound was the squeak of his shoes on the snow. The big thermometer over the door of the Granite State Savings Bank stood at 3 degrees, and the air had that feeling of total silent inertia that belongs exclusively to cold New Hampshire mornings. Nothing moved. The roadway was empty. The windshields of the parked cars were blinded with cataracts of frost. Dark windows, drawn shades. To Johnny it all seemed somehow dreadful, and at the same time holy. He fought the feeling. This was no holy business he was on. He crossed Jasper Street, and there was the town hall, standing white and austerely elegant behind its plowed banks of twinkling snow. "What you gonna do if the front door's locked, smart guy?" Well, he would find a way to cross that bridge if he had to.
Johnny looked around, but there was no one to see him. If this had been the president coming for one of his famous town meetings, everything would have been different, of course. The place would have been blocked off since the night before, and men would be stationed inside already. But this was only a U.S. representative. One of over 400. No big deal. No big deal yet. Johnny went up the steps and tried the door. The knob turned easily, and he stepped into the cold entryway and pulled the door shut behind him. Now the headache was coming back, pulsing along with the steady, thick beat of his heart. He set his case down and massaged his temples with his gloved fingers. There was a sudden low scream. The coat closet door was opening very slowly, and then something white was falling out of the shadows toward him. Johnny barely held back a cry. For one moment, he thought it was a body falling out of the closet like something from a spook movie. But it was only a heavy cardboard sign that read, "Please have papers in order before appearing for examination." He set it back in place, and then turned to the doorway, giving upon the stairs. This door was now locked. He leaned down to get a better look at it in the dim white glow of the streetlight that filtered in the one window. It was a spring lock, and he thought he might be able to open it with a coat hanger. He found one in the coat closet and hooked the neck of it into the crack between the door and the jamb. He worked it down to the lock and began to fumble around. His head was thudding fiercely now. At last, he heard the bolt snap back as the wire caught it. He pulled the door open. He picked up his attaché case and went through, still holding the coat hanger. He pulled the door closed behind him and heard it lock again. He went up the narrow stairs, which creaked and groaned under his weight. At the top of the stairs, there was a short hallway with several doors on either side. He walked down the hall, past town manager and town selectman, past tax assessor and men's, and overseer of the poor and ladies. There was an unmarked door at the end. It was unlocked, and he came out onto the gallery above the rear of the meeting hall, which was spread out below him in a crazy quilt of shadows. He closed the door behind him and shivered a little at the soft stir of echoes in the empty hall. His footfalls also echoed back as he walked to the right along the rear gallery, then turned left. Now he was walking along the right-hand side of the hall, about 25 feet above the floor. He stopped at a point above the wood stove and directly across from the podium where Stilson would be standing in about 5.5 hours. He sat down cross-legged and rested for a while, tried to get in control of the headache with some deep breathing. The wood stove wasn't operating, and he felt the cold settling steadily against him, and then into him. Previews of the winding shroud. When he'd begun to feel a little better, he thumbed the catches on the attaché case. The double click echoed back as his footfalls had done, and this time it was the sound of cocking pistols. Western justice, he thought, for no reason at all. That was what the prosecutor had said when the jury found Claudine Longette guilty of shooting her lover. She's found out what Western justice means. Johnny looked down into the case and rubbed his eyes. His vision doubled briefly, and then things came together again. He was getting an impression from the very wood he was sitting on. A very old impression. If it had been a photograph, it would have been sepia-toned. Men standing here and smoking cigars, talking and laughing, and waiting for town meeting to begin. Had it been 1920? 1902? There was something ghostly about it that made him feel uneasy. One of them had been talking about the price of whiskey and cleaning his nose with a silver toothpick and 2 years before he had poisoned his wife. Johnny shivered. Whatever the impression was, it didn't matter. It was an impression of a man who was long dead now. The rifle gleamed up at him. When men do it in wartime, they give them medals, he thought. He began to assemble the rifle. Each click echoed back just once, solemnly, the sound of a cocking pistol. He loaded the Remington with 5 bullets. He placed it across his knees and waited. 3. Dawn came slowly. Johnny dozed a little, but he was too cold now to do more than doze. Thin, sketchy dreams haunted what sleep he did get. He came fully awake at a little past 7. The door below was thrown open with a crash, and he had to bite his tongue to keep from crying out, "Who's there?" It was the custodian. Johnny put his eye to one of the diamond shapes cut into the balustrade and saw a burly man who was bundled up in a thick navy peacoat. He was coming up the center aisle with an armload of firewood. He was humming Red River Valley. He dropped the armload of wood into the wood box with a crash and then disappeared below Johnny. A second later, he heard the thin, screeing noise of the stove's firebox door being swung open. Johnny suddenly thought of the plume of vapor he was producing every time he exhaled. Suppose the custodian looked up. Would he be able to see that? He tried to slow the rate of his breathing, but that made his head ache worse, and his vision doubled alarmingly. Now there was a crackle of paper being crumpled, then the scratch of a match, a faint whiff of sulfur in the cold air. The custodian went on humming Red River Valley, and then broke into loud and tuneless song.
From this valley they say you are going. We will miss your bright eyes and sweet smile.
Now a different crackling sound. Fire. That's got it, you sucker, the custodian said from directly below Johnny. And then there was the sound of the firebox door being slammed shut again. Johnny pressed both hands over his mouth like a bandage, suddenly afflicted with suicidal amusement. He saw himself rising up from the floor of the gallery, as thin and white as any self-respecting ghost. He saw himself spread his arms like wings and his fingers like talons, and calling down in hollow tones,
"That's got you, you sucker."
He held the laughter behind his hands. His head throbbed like a tomato full of hot, expanding blood. His vision jittered and blurred crazily. Suddenly he wanted very badly to move away from the impression of the man who had been cleaning his nose with the silver toothpick, but he didn't dare make a sound. Dear Jesus, what if he had to sneeze? Suddenly, with no warning, a terrible wavering shriek filled the hall, drilling into Johnny's ears like thin silver nails climbing, making his head vibrate. He opened his mouth to scream. It cut off.
"Oh, you whore," the custodian said conversationally.
Johnny looked through the diamond and saw the custodian standing behind the podium and fiddling with a microphone. The mic cord snaked down to a small portable amp. The custodian went down the few steps from the podium to the floor and pulled the amplifier farther from the mic, then fooled with the dials on top of it. He went back to the mic and turned it on again. There was another feedback whine, this one lower, and then tapering away entirely. Johnny pressed his hands tight against his forehead and rubbed them back and forth. The custodian tapped on the mic with his thumb, and the sound filled the big empty room. It sounded like a fist knocking on a coffin lid. Then his voice, still tuneless, but now amplified to the point of monstrosity, a giant's voice bludgeoning into Johnny's head.
From this valley they say you are going.
Stop it, Johnny wanted to scream. Oh, please stop it. I'm going crazy. Can't you stop it? The singing ended with a loud, amplified snap, and the custodian said in his own voice, "That's got you, whore." He walked out of Johnny's line of sight again. There was a sound of tearing paper and the low, popping sounds of twine being snapped. Then the custodian reappeared, whistling and holding a large stack of booklets.
he began to place them at close intervals along the benches. When he'd finished that chore, the custodian buttoned his coat and left the hall. The door slammed hollowly shut behind him. Johnny looked at his watch. It was 7:45. The town hall was warming up a little. He sat and waited. The headache was still very bad, but oddly enough, it was easier to bear than it had ever been before. All he had to do was tell himself that he wouldn't have to bear it for long. 4. The door slammed open again promptly at 9 o'clock, startling him out of a catnap. His hands clamped tightly over the rifle and then relaxed. He put his eye to the diamond-shaped peephole. 4 men this time. One of them was the custodian, the collar of his peacoat turned up against his neck. The other 3 were wearing topcoats with suits underneath. Johnny felt his heartbeat quicken. One of them was Sonny Elliman. His hair was cut short now and handsomely styled, but the brilliant green eyes had not changed.
"Everything set?" he asked. "Check for yourself," the custodian said. "Don't be offended, Dad," one of the others replied.
They were moving to the front of the hall. One of them clicked the amplifier on and then clicked it off again, satisfied.
"People around these parts act like he was the bloody emperor," the custodian grumbled.
He is," the 3rd man said.
Johnny thought he also recognized this fellow from the Trimble rally.
"Haven't you got wise to that yet, Pop?"
"Have you been upstairs?"
Elliman asked the custodian. And Johnny went cold.
"Stairway door's locked," the custodian answered. "Same as always. I gave her a shake."
Johnny silently gave thanks for the spring lock on the door.
"Ought to check it out," Elliman said.
The custodian uttered an exasperated laugh.
"I don't know about you guys," he said. "Who are you expecting? The Phantom of the Opera?" "Come on, Sonny," the fellow Johnny thought he recognized said. "There's nobody up there. We just got time for a coffee if we shag ass down to the restaurant on the corner."
"That's not coffee," Sonny said. "Fucking mud is all that is. Just run upstairs first and make sure no one's there, Moochie. We go by the book."
Johnny licked his lips and clutched the gun. He looked up and down the narrow gallery. To his right it ended in a blank wall. To his left it went back to the suite of offices. In either way it made no difference. If he moved, they would hear him. This empty, the town hall served as a natural amplifier. He was stuck. There were footfalls down below, then the sound of the door between the hall and the entryway being opened and closed. Johnny waited, frozen and helpless. Just below him, the custodian and the other 2 were talking, but he heard nothing they said. His head had turned on his neck like some slow engine, and he stared down the length of the gallery, waiting for the fellow Sonny Elliman had called Moochie to appear at the end of it. His bored expression would suddenly turn to shock and incredulity. His mouth would open.
"Hey, Sonny, there's a guy up here."
Now he could hear the muffled sound of Moochie climbing the stairs. He tried to think of something, anything. Nothing came. They were going to discover him. It was less than a minute away now, and he didn't have any idea of how to stop it from happening. No matter what he did, his one chance was on the verge of being blown. Doors began to open and close, the sound of each drawing closer and less muffled. A drop of sweat spilled from Johnny's forehead and darkened the leg of his jeans. He could remember each door he'd come past on his way here. Moochie had checked town manager and town selectman and tax assessor. Now he was opening the door of men's. Now he was glancing through the office that belonged to the overseer of the poor. Now the ladies' room. The next door would be the one leading to the galleries. It opened. There was the sound of 2 footfalls as Moochie approached the railing of the short gallery that ran along the back of the hall.
"Okay, Sonny. You satisfied? Everything looked good?"
"Looks like a fucking dump," Moochie responded.
and there was a burst of laughter from below. "Well, come on down and let's go for coffee," the third man said. And incredibly, that was it. The door slammed to. The footsteps retreated back down the hall, and then down the steps to the first floor. Johnny went limp, and for a moment everything swam away from him into shades of gray. The slam of the entryway door as they went out for their coffee brought him partially out of it. Below, the custodian presented his judgment.
"Bunch of whores."
Then he left too, and for the next 20 minutes or so, there was only Johnny.
5. Around 9:30 a.m., the people of Jackson began to file into their town hall. The first to appear was a trio of old ladies dressed in formal black, chattering together like magpies. Johnny watched them pick seats close to the stove, almost entirely out of the field of his vision, and pick up the booklets that had been left on the seats. The booklets appeared to be filled with glossy pictures of Greg Stilson.
"I just love that man," one of the three said. "I've gotten his autograph 3 times, and I'll get it again today, I'll be bound."
That was all the talk there was about Greg Stilson. The ladies went on to discuss the impending Old Home Sunday at the Methodist Church. Johnny, almost directly over the stove, went from very cold to very hot. He had taken advantage of the slack tide between the departure of Stilson's security people and the arrival of his first townsfolk, using it to shed both his jacket and his outer shirt. He kept wiping sweat from his face with a handkerchief, and the linen was streaked with blood as well as sweat. His bad eye was kicking up again, and his vision was constantly blurred and reddish. The door below opened. There was the hearty tromp, tromp, tromp of men stamping snow from their packs, and then 4 men in checked woolen jackets came down the aisle and sat in the front row. One of them launched immediately into a Frenchman joke. A young woman of about 23 arrived with her son, who looked about 4. The boy was wearing a blue snowmobile suit with bright yellow markings, and he wanted to know if he could talk into the microphone. "No, dear," the woman said, and they went down behind the men. The boy immediately began to kick his feet against the bench in front of him, and one of the men glanced back over his shoulder.
"Matt, stop that," she said.
9:45 now. The door was opening and closing with a steady regularity. Men and women of all types and occupations and ages were filling up the hall. There was a drifting hum of conversation, and it was edged with an indefinable sense of anticipation. They weren't here to quiz their duly elected representative. They were waiting for a bona fide star turn in their small community. Johnny knew that most Meet Your Candidate and Meet Your Representative sessions were attended by a handful of diehards in the nearly empty meeting halls. During the election of 1976, a debate between Maine's Bill Cohen and his challenger, Leighton Cooney, had attracted all of 26 people, press aside. The skull sessions were so much window dressing, a self-testimonial to wave when election time came around again. Most could have been held in a middling-sized closet. But by 10 a.m., every seat in the town hall was taken, and there were 20 or 30 standees at the back. Every time the door opened, Johnny's hands tensed down on the rifle, and he was still not positive he could do it, no matter what the stakes. 5 past. 10 past. Johnny began to think Stilson had been held up, or was perhaps not coming at all, and the feeling which moved stealthily through him was one of relief. Then the door opened again, and a hearty voice called,
"Hey, how you doing, Jackson, New Hampshire?"
A startled, pleased murmur. Someone called ecstatically,
"Greg, how are you?"
"Well, I'm feeling perky,"
Stilson came right back.
"How the heck are you?"
A spatter of applause quickly swelled to a roar of approval.
"Hey, all right,"
Greg shouted over it. He moved quickly down the aisle, shaking hands toward the podium. Johnny watched him through his loophole.
Stilson was wearing a heavy rawhide coat with a sheepskin collar, and today the hard hat had been replaced with a woolen ski cap with a bright red tassel. He paused at the head of the aisle and waved at the three or four press in attendance. Flashpacks popped, and the applause got its second wind, shaking the rafters. And Johnny Smith suddenly knew it was now or never. The feelings he had had about Greg Stilson at the Trimble rally suddenly swept over him again with a certain and terrible clarity. Inside his aching, tortured head, he seemed to hear a dull wooden sound. Two things came together with terrible force at one single moment. It was, perhaps, the sound of destiny. It would be too easy to delay, to let Stilson talk and talk. Too easy to let him get away, to sit up here with his head in his hands, waiting as the crowd thinned out, waiting as the custodian returned to dismantle the sound system and sweep up the litter, all the time kidding himself that there would be next week in another town. The time was now, indisputably now, and every human being on Earth suddenly had a stake in what happened in this backwater meeting house. That thudding sound in his head, like poles of destiny coming together. Stilson was mounting the steps to the podium. The area behind him was clear. The three men in their open top coats were lounging against the far wall. Johnny stood up.
6. Everything seemed to happen in slow motion. There were cramps in his legs from sitting so long. His knees popped like dud firecrackers. Time seemed frozen. The applause went on and on, even though heads were turning, necks were craning. Someone screamed through the applause, and still it went on. Someone had screamed because there was a man in the gallery, and the man was holding a rifle, and this was something they had all seen on TV. It was a situation with classic elements that they all recognized. In its own way, it was as American as the wonderful world of Disney. The politician and the man in a high place with the gun. Greg Stilson turned toward him, his thick neck craning, wrinkling into creases. The red puff on the top of his ski cap bobbed. Johnny put the rifle to his shoulder. It seemed to float up there, and he felt the thud as it socketed home next to the joint there. He thought of shooting partridge with his dad as a boy. They had gone deer hunting, but the only time Johnny had ever seen one, he had not been able to pull the trigger. The buck fever had gotten him. It was a secret, as shameful as masturbation, and he had never told anyone. There was another scream. One of the old ladies was clutching her mouth, and Johnny saw there was artificial fruit scattered along the wide brim of her black hat. Faces turned up to him, big white zeros, open mouths, small black zeros. The little boy in the snowmobile suit was pointing. His mother was trying to shield him. Stilson was in the gun sight suddenly, and Johnny remembered to flick off the rifle's safety. Across the way, the men in the top coats were reaching inside their jackets, and Sonny Elliman, his green eyes blazing, was hollering, "Down! Greg, get down!" But Stilson stared up into the gallery, and for the second time, their eyes locked together in a perfect sort of understanding, and Stilson only ducked at the same instant Johnny fired. The rifle's roar was loud, filling the place, and the slug took away nearly one whole corner of the podium, peeling it back to the bare, bright wood. Splinters flew. One of them struck the microphone, and there was another monstrous whine of feedback that suddenly ended in a guttural, low-key buzzing. Johnny pumped another cartridge into the chamber and fired again. This time, the slug punched a hole through the dusty carpeting of the dais. The crowd had started to move, panicky as cattle. They all drove into the center aisle. The people who had been standing at the rear escaped easily, but then a bottleneck of cursing, screaming men and women formed in the double doorway. There were popping noises from the other side of the hall, and suddenly part of the gallery railing splintered up in front of Johnny's eyes. Something screamed past his ear a second later. Then an invisible finger gave the collar of his shirt a flick. All three of them across the way were holding handguns, and because Johnny was up in the gallery, their field of fire was crystal clear. But Johnny doubted if they would have bothered over much about innocent bystanders anyway. One of the trio of old women grabbed Moochie's arm. She was sobbing, trying to ask something. He flung her away and steadied his gun in both hands. There was a stink of gunpowder in the hall now. It had been about 20 seconds since Johnny had stood up.
Down! Down, Greg!
Stilson was still standing at the edge of the dais, crouching slightly, looking up. Johnny brought the rifle down, and for an instant Stilson was dead bang in front sight. Then a pistol slug grooved his neck, knocking him backward, and his own shot went wild into the air. The window across the way dissolved in a tinkling rain of glass. Thin screams drifted up from below. Blood poured down and across his shoulder and chest.
"Oh, you're doing a great job of killing him,"
he thought hysterically, and pushed back to the railing again. He levered another cartridge into the breech and threw it to his shoulder again. Now Stilson was on the move. He darted down the steps to floor level and then glanced up at Johnny again. Another bullet whizzed by his temple.
"I'm bleeding like a stuck pig," he thought. "Come on. Come on and get this over."
The bottleneck at the entryway broke, and now people began to pour out. A puff of smoke rose from the barrel of one of the pistols across the way. There was a bang, and the invisible finger that had flicked his collar a few seconds ago now drew a line of fire across the side of Johnny's head. It didn't matter. Nothing mattered, except taking Stilson. He brought the rifle down again.
"Make this one count."
Stilson moved with good speed for such a big man. The dark-haired young woman Johnny had noticed earlier was about halfway up the center aisle, holding her crying son in her arms, still trying to shield him with her body. And what Stilson did then so dumbfounded Johnny that he almost dropped the rifle altogether. He snatched the boy from his mother's arms, whirled toward the gallery, holding the boy's body in front of him. It was no longer Greg Stilson in the front sight, but a small, squirming figure in the filter, blue filter, yellow stripes, tiger stripes, a dark blue snowmobile suit with bright yellow piping. Johnny's mouth dropped open. It was Stilson, all right, the tiger, but he was behind the filter now.
"What does it mean?"
Johnny screamed, but no sound passed his lips. The mother screamed shrilly then, but Johnny had heard it all somewhere before.
"Matt! Give him to me! Matt! Give him to me, you bastard!"
Johnny's head was swelling blackly, expanding like a bladder. Everything was starting to fade. The only brightness left was centered around the notched gun sight. The gun sight now laid directly over the chest of that blue snowmobile suit.
"Do it! Oh, for Christ's sake, you have to do it. He'll get away."
And now, perhaps it was only his blurring eyesight that made it seem so, the blue snowmobile suit began to spread, its color washing out to the light robin's egg color of the vision, the dark yellow stretching, striping until everything began to be lost in it.
"Behind the filter, yes. He's behind the filter. But what does it mean? Does it mean it's safe? Or just that he's beyond my reach? What does it—"
Warm fire flashed somewhere below and was gone. Some dim part of Johnny's mind registered it as a flashback. Stilson shoved the woman away and back toward the door, eyes squeezed into calculating pirate slits. He held the squirming boy firmly by the neck and the crotch.
"Can't. Oh, dear God, forgive me. I can't."
Two more bullets struck him then. One high in the chest, driving him back against the wall and bouncing him off it, the second into the left side of his midsection, spinning him around into the gallery railing. He was dimly aware that he had lost the rifle. It struck the gallery floor and discharged point blank into the wall. Then his upper thighs crashed into the balustrade and he was falling. The town hall turned over twice before his eyes, and then there was a splintering crash as he struck two of the benches, breaking his back and both legs. He opened his mouth to scream, but what came out was a great gush of blood. He lay in the splintered remains of the benches he had struck and thought, "It's over. I punked out. Blew it." Hands were on him, not gentle. They were turning him over. Elliman, Mucci, and the other guy were there. Elliman was the one who had turned him over. Stilson came, shoving Mucci aside.
"Never mind this guy," he said harshly. "Find the son of a bitch that took that picture. Smash his camera."
Mucci and the other guy left. Somewhere close by, the woman with the dark hair was crying out,
"Behind a kid! Hiding behind a kid, and I'll tell everybody!"
"Shut her up, Sonny," Stilson said. "Sure," Sonny said, and left Stilson's side.
Stilson got down on his knees above Johnny.
"Do we know each other, fella? No sense lying. You've had the course."
Johnny whispered, "We knew each other."
"It was that Trimble rally, wasn't it?"
Johnny nodded. Stilson got up abruptly, and with the last bit of his strength, Johnny reached out and grasped his ankle. It was only for a second. Stilson pulled free easily, but it was long enough. Everything had changed. People were drawing near him now, but he saw only feet and legs, no faces. It didn't matter. Everything had changed. He began to cry a little. Touching Stilson this time had been like touching a blank, dead battery, fallen tree, empty house, bare bookshelves, wine bottles ready for candles. Fading, going away. The feet and legs around him were becoming misty and indistinct. He heard their voices, the excited gabble of speculation, but not the words, only the sound of the words, and even that was fading, blurring into a high, sweet humming sound. He looked over his shoulder, and there was the corridor he had emerged from so long ago. He had come out of that corridor and into this bright placental place. Only then his mother had been alive, and his father had been there calling him by name until he broke through to them. Now it was only time to go back. Now it was right to go back. "I did it. Somehow I did it. I don't understand how, but I have." He let himself drift toward the corridor with the dark chrome walls, not knowing if there might be something at the far end of it or not, content to let time show him that. The sweet hum of the voices faded. The misty brightness faded. But he was still he, Johnny Smith, intact. "Get into the corridor," he thought. "All right." He thought that if he could get into that corridor, he would be able to walk. Part 3. Notes from the Dead Zone. 1. Portsmouth, New Hampshire, January 23rd, 1979. Dear Dad, this is a terrible letter to have to write, and I will try to keep it short. When you get it, I guess I will probably be dead. An awful thing has happened to me, and I think now that it may have started a long time before the car accident and the coma. You know about the psychic business, of course, and you may remember Mom swearing on her deathbed that God had meant for it to be this way, that God had something for me to do. She asked me not to run from it, and I promised her that I wouldn't, not meaning it seriously, but wanting her mind to be easy. Now it looks as if she was right, in a funny sort of way. I still don't really believe in God. Not in a real being who plans for us and gives us all little jobs to do, like Boy Scouts winning merit badges on the great hike of life. But neither do I believe that all the things that have happened to me are blind chance. In the summer of 1976, Dad, I went to a Greg Stilson rally in Trimble, which is in New Hampshire's 3rd District. He was running for the first time then, you may recall. When he was on his way to the speaker's rostrum, he shook a lot of hands,
and one of them was mine. This is the part you may find hard to believe, even though you have seen the ability in action. I had one of my flashes, only this one was no flash, Dad. It was a vision, either in the biblical sense or in something very near it. Oddly enough, it wasn't as clear as some of my other insights have been. There was a puzzling blue glow over everything that has never been there before, but it was incredibly powerful. I saw Greg Stilson as President of the United States. How far in the future, I can't say, except that he had lost most of his hair. I would say 14 years or perhaps 18 at the most. Now, my ability is to see and not to interpret. And in this case, my ability to see was impeded by that funny blue filter. But I saw enough. If Stilson becomes president, he's going to worsen an international situation that is going to be pretty awful to begin with. If Stilson becomes president, he's going to end up precipitating a full-scale nuclear war. I believe that the initial flashpoint for this war is going to be in South Africa. And also I believe that in the short, bloody course of this war, it's not going to be just two or three nations throwing warheads, but maybe as many as 20-plus terrorist groups. Daddy, I know how crazy this must look. It looks crazy to me, but I have no doubts, no urge to look back over my shoulder and try to second-guess this thing into something less real and urgent than it is. You never knew. No one did. But I didn't run away from the Chatsworths because of that restaurant fire. I guess I was running away from Greg Stilson and the thing I am supposed to do. Like Elijah, hiding in his cave, or Jonah, who ended up in the fish's belly. I thought I would just wait and see, you know? Wait and see if the preconditions for such a horrible future began to come into place. I would probably be waiting still. But in the fall of last year, the headaches began to get worse. And there was an incident on the road crew I was working with. I guess Keith Strang, the foreman, would remember that. 2. Excerpt from testimony given before the so-called Stilson Committee, chaired by Senator William Cohen of Maine. The questioner is Mr. Norman D. Veritzer, the committee's chief counsel. The witness is Mr. Keith Strang of 1421 Desert Boulevard, Phoenix, Arizona. Date of testimony, August 17, 1979. And at this time, John Smith was in the employ of the Phoenix Public Works Department, was he not? Yes, sir, he was. This was early December of 1978. Yes, sir. And did something happen on December 7th that you particularly remember? Something concerning John Smith? Yes, sir, it sure did. Tell the committee about that, if you would. Well, I had to go back to the central motor pool to get 2 40-gallon drums of orange paint. We were lining roads, you understand. Johnny, that's Johnny Smith, was out on Rosemont Avenue on the day you're talking about, putting down new lane markings. Well, I got back out there at approximately 4:15, about 45 minutes before knocking off time, and this fellow, Herman Jolin, that you've already talked to, he comes up to me and says, "You better check on Johnny, Keith. Something's wrong with Johnny. I tried to talk to him, and he acted like he didn't hear. He almost run me down. You better get him straight." That's what he said, so I said, "What's wrong with him, Hermie?" And Hermie says, "Check it out for yourself. There's something off whack with that dude." So I drove on up the road, and at first everything was all right, and then, wow. What did you see? Before I saw Johnny, you mean? Yes, that's right. The line he was putting down started to go haywire. Just a little bit at first, a jig here and there, a little bubble. It wasn't perfectly straight, you know. And Johnny had always been the best liner on the whole crew. Then, it started to get really bad. It started to go all over the road in these big loops and swirls. Some places it was like he'd gone right around in circles a few times. For about 100 yards, he'd put the stripe right along the dirt shoulder. What did you do? I stopped him. That is, eventually I stopped him. I pulled up right beside the lining machine and started yelling at him. Must have yelled half a dozen times. It was like he didn't hear. Then he swooped that thing toward me and put a hell of a ding in the side of the car I was driving. Highway department property, too. So I laid on the horn and yelled at him again, and that seemed to get through to him. He threw it in neutral and looked over at me. I asked him what in the name of God he thought he was doing. And what was his response? He said, "Hi." That was all. "Hi, Keith." Like everything was hunky-dory. "And your response was?" My response was pretty blue. I was mad. And Johnny's just standing there looking all around and holding on to the side of the liner like he would fall down if he let go. That was when I realized how sick he looked. He was always thin, you know, but now he looked as white as paper, and the side of his mouth was kind of, you know, drawn down. At first, he didn't even seem to get what I was saying. Then he looked around and saw the way that line was, all over the road. And he said he was sorry. Then he kind of, I don't know, staggered and put one hand up to his face. So I asked him what was wrong with him, and he said, "Oh, a lot of confused stuff. It didn't mean anything." "Mr. Strang, the committee is particularly interested in anything Mr. Smith said that might cast a light on this matter. Can you remember what he said?" "Well, at first he said there was nothing wrong except that it smelled like rubber tires, tires on fire. Then he said, that battery will explode if you try to jump it. And something like, I got potatoes in the chest and both radios are in the sun, so it's all out for the trees." That's the best I can remember. Like I say, it was all confused and crazy. "What happened then?" "He started to fall down, so I grabbed him by the shoulder and his hand. He'd been holding it against the side of his face. It came away, and I saw his right eye was full of blood. Then he passed out." "But he said one more thing before he passed out, did he not?" "Yes, sir, he did." "And what was that?" "He said, 'We'll worry about Stilson later, Daddy. He's in the dead zone now.'" "Are you sure that's what he said?" "Yes, sir, I am. I'll never forget it." 3. And when I woke up, I was in the small equipment shed at the base of Rosemont Drive. Keith said I'd better get to see a doctor right away, and I wasn't to come back to work until I did. I was scared, Dad, but not for the reasons Keith thought, I guess. Anyway, I made an appointment to see a neurologist that Sam Wyzak had mentioned to me in a letter he wrote in early November. You see, I'd written to Sam telling him that I was afraid to drive a car because I was having some incidents of double vision. Sam wrote back right away and told me to go see this Dr. Van, said he considered the symptoms very alarming, but wouldn't presume to diagnose long distance. I didn't go right away. I guess your mind can screw you over pretty well. And I kept thinking, right up to the incident with the road lining machine, that it was just a phase I was going through, and that it would get better. I guess I just didn't want to think about the alternative. But the road lining incident was too much. I went because I was getting scared. Not just for myself, because of what I knew. So I went to see this Dr. Van, and he gave me the tests, and then he laid it out for me. It turned out I didn't have as much time as I thought, because... 4. Excerpt from testimony given before the so-called Stilson Committee, chaired by Senator William Cohen of Maine. The questioner is Mr. Norman D. Veritzer, the committee's chief counsel. The witness is Dr. Quentin M. Van of 17 Parkland Drive, Phoenix, Arizona. Date of testimony, August 22, 1979. After your tests were complete and your diagnosis was complete, you saw John Smith in your office, didn't you?
Yes, it was a difficult meeting. Such meetings are always difficult.
Can you give us the substance of what passed between you?
Yes.
Under these unusual circumstances, I believe that the doctor-patient relationship may be waived. I began by pointing out to Smith that he had had a terribly frightening experience. He agreed. His right eye was still extremely bloodshot, but it was better. He had ruptured a small capillary. If I may refer to the chart, material deleted and condensed at this point. And after making this explanation to Smith, he asked me for the bottom line. That was his phrase, the bottom line. In a quiet way, he impressed me with his calmness and his courage. And the bottom line was what, Dr. Van? Huh? I thought that would be clear by now. John Smith had an extremely well-developed brain tumor in the parietal lobe. Disorder among spectators, short recess.
Doctor, I'm sorry about this interruption. I'd like to remind the spectators that this committee is in session, and that it is an investigatory body, not a freak show. I'll have order, or I'll have the sergeant-at-arms clear the room.
That is quite all right, Mr. Varitzer.
Thank you, Doctor. Can you tell the committee how Smith took the news?
He was calm, extraordinarily calm. I believe that in his heart he had formed his own diagnosis, and that his and mine happened to coincide. He said that he was badly scared, however, and he asked me how long he had to live.
What did you tell him?
I said that at that point such a question was meaningless because our options were all still open. I told him he would need an operation. I should point out that at this time I had no knowledge of his coma and his extraordinary, almost miraculous, recovery. And what was his response? He said there would be no operation. He was quiet but very, very firm. No operation. I said that I hoped he would reconsider, because to turn such an operation down would be to sign his own death warrant.
Did Smith make any response to this?
He asked me to give him my best opinion on how long he could live without such an operation.
Did you give him your opinion?
I gave him a ballpark estimate, yes. I told him that tumors have extremely erratic growth patterns and that I had known patients whose tumors had fallen dormant for as long as 2 years, but that such a dormancy was quite rare. I told him that without an operation, he might reasonably expect to live from 8 to 20 months.
But he still declined the operation, is that right?
Yes, that is so.
Did something unusual happen as Smith was leaving?
I would say it was extremely unusual.
Tell the committee about that, if you would.
I touched his shoulder, meaning to restrain him, I suppose. I was unwilling to see the man leave under those circumstances, you understand. And I felt something coming from him when I did. It was a sensation like an electric shock, but it was also an oddly draining, debilitating sensation, as if he were drawing something from me. I'll grant you that this is an extremely subjective description, but it comes from a man trained in the art and craft of professional observation. It was not pleasant, I assure you. I drew away from him, and he suggested I call my wife because Strawberry had hurt himself seriously.
Strawberry?
Yes, that's what he said. My wife's brother, his name is Stanberry Richards. My youngest son always called him Uncle Strawberry when he was very small. That association didn't occur until later, by the way. That evening I suggested to my wife that she call her brother, who lives in the town of Coos Lake, New York.
Did she call him?
Yes, she did. They had a very nice chat.
And was Mr. Richards, your brother-in-law, was he all right?
Yes, he was fine. But the following week, he fell from a ladder while painting his house and broke his back.
Dr. Van, do you believe John Smith saw this happen? Do you believe that he had a precognitive vision concerning your wife's brother?
I don't know, but I believe that it may have been so.
Thank you, Doctor.
May I say one more thing?
Of course.
If he did have such a curse, yes, I would call it a curse. I hope God will show pity to that man's tortured soul.
5. And I know, Dad,
the people are going to say that I did what I am planning to do because of the tumor. But, Daddy, don't believe them. It isn't true. The tumor is only the accident finally catching up with me. The accident, which I now believe, never stopped happening. The tumor lies in the same area that was injured in the crash. The same area that I now believe was probably bruised when I was a child and took a fall one day while skating on Runaround Pond. That was when I had the first of my flashes, although even now I cannot remember exactly what it was. And I had another just before the accident, at the Estee Fair. Ask Sarah about that one. I'm sure she remembers. The tumor lies in that area which I always called the dead zone. And that turned out to be right, didn't it? All too bitterly right. God, destiny, providence, fate, whatever you want to call it, seems to be reaching out with its steady and unarguable hand to put the scales back in balance again. Perhaps I was meant to die in that car crash, or even earlier, that day on the runaround. And I believe that when I've finished what I have to finish, the scales will come completely back into balance again. Daddy, I love you. The worst thing, next to the belief that the gun is the only way out of this terrible deadlock I find myself in, is knowing that I'll be leaving you behind to bear the grief and hate of those who have no reason to believe Stilson is anything but a good and just man. 6. Excerpt from testimony given before the so-called Stilson Committee, chaired by Senator William Cohen of Maine. The questioner is Mr. Albert Renfrew, the committee's deputy counsel. The witness is Dr. Samuel Wyzak of 26 Harlow Court, Bangor, Maine. Date of testimony, August 23, 1979. We are now approaching the hour of adjournment, Dr. Wyzak, and on behalf of the committee, I would like to thank you for the last 4 long hours of testimony. You have offered a great deal of light on the situation. That's quite all right. I have one final question for you, Dr. Wyzak, one which seems to me to be of nearly ultimate importance. It speaks to an issue which John Smith himself raised in a letter to his father, which has been entered into evidence. The question is, no. I beg your pardon? You are preparing to ask me if Johnny's tumor pulled the trigger that day in New Hampshire, are you not? In a manner of speaking, I suppose, the answer is no. Johnny Smith was a thinking, reasoning human being until the end of his life. The letter to his father shows this. His letter to Sarah Hazlitt also shows this. He was a man with a terrible godlike power. Perhaps a curse, as my colleague Dr. Van has called it. But he was neither unhinged nor acting upon fantasies caused by cranial pressure, if such a thing is even possible. But isn't it true that Charles Whitman, the so-called Texas Tower sniper, had? Yes, yes, he had a tumor. So did the pilot of the Eastern Airlines airplane that crashed in Florida some years ago. And it has never been suggested that the tumor was a precipitating cause in either case. I would point out to you that other infamous creatures, Richard Speck, the so-called Son of Sam, and Adolf Hitler, needed no brain tumors to cause them to act in a homicidal manner. Or Frank Dodd, the murderer Johnny himself uncovered in the town of Castle Rock. However misguided this committee may find Johnny's act to have been, it was the act of a man who was sane. In great mental agony, perhaps, but sane. 7. And most of all, don't believe that I did this without the longest and most agonizing reflection. If by killing him I could be sure that the human race was gaining another 4 years, another 2, even another 8 months in which to think it over, it would be worth it. It's wrong, but it may turn out right. I don't know. But I won't play Hamlet any longer. I know how dangerous Stilson is. Daddy, I love you very much. Believe it. Your son, Johnny.
8. Excerpt from testimony given before the so-called Stilson Committee, chaired by Senator William Cohen of Maine. The questioner is Mr. Albert Renfrew, the committee's deputy counsel. The witness is Mr. Stuart Clausen of the Blackstrap Road in Jackson, New Hampshire. And you say you just happened to grab your camera, Mr. Clausen?
Yeah. Just as I went out the door, I almost didn't even go that day, even though I like Greg Stilson. Well, I did like him before all of this, anyway. The town hall just seemed like a bummer to me, you know?
Because of your driver's exam.
You got it. Flunking that permit test was one colossal bummer, but at the end I said, what the hell? And I got the picture. Wow! I got it. That picture's gonna make me rich, I guess. Just like the flag raising on Iwo Jima.
I hope you don't get the idea that the entire thing was staged for your benefit, young man.
Oh, no, not at all. I only meant, well, I don't know what I meant, but it happened right in front of me, and I don't know. Geez, I was just glad I had my Nikon, that's all.
You just snapped the photo when Stilson picked up the child.
Matt Robeson, yes, sir.
And this is a blow-up of that photo.
That's my picture, yes.
And after you took it, what happened?
Two of those goons ran after me. They were yelling, give us the camera, kid, drop it. Shit, stuff like that.
And you ran.
Did I run? Holy God, I guess I ran. They chased me almost all the way to the town garage. One of them almost had me, but he slipped on the ice and fell down.
Young man, I'd like to suggest that you won the most important foot race of your life when you outran those two thugs.
Thank you, sir. What Stilson did that day, maybe he had to be there, but holding a little kid in front of you, that's pretty low. I bet the people in New Hampshire wouldn't vote for that guy for dog catcher. Not for...
Thank you, Mr. Clausen. The witness is excused. 9. October again. Sarah had avoided this trip for a very long time. But now the time had come, and it could be put off no longer. She felt that. She had left both children with Mrs. Ablinap. They had house help now, and two cars instead of the little red Pinto. Walt's income was scraping near $30,000 a year, and had come by herself to Pownall through the burning blaze of late autumn. Now she pulled over on the shoulder of a pretty little country road, got out, and crossed to the small cemetery on the other side. A small, tarnished plaque on one of the stone posts announced that this was the Birches. It was enclosed by a rambling rock wall, and the grounds were neatly kept. A few faded flags remained from Memorial Day 5 months ago. Soon, they would be buried under snow. She walked slowly, not hurrying, the breeze catching the hem of her dark green skirt and fluttering it. Here were generations of Bowdens. Here was a whole family of Marstons. Here, grouped around a large marble memorial, were Pillsbury's going back to 1750. And near the rear wall, she found a relatively new stone, which read simply, John Smith. Sarah knelt beside it, hesitated, touched it. She let her fingertips skate thoughtfully over its polished surface. 10. January 23rd, 1979. Dear Sarah, I've just written my father a very important letter, and it took me nearly an hour and a half to work my way through it. I just don't have the energy to repeat the effort, so I'm going to suggest that you call him as soon as you receive this. Go do it now, Sarah, before you read the rest of this. So now, in all probability, you know. I just wanted to tell you that I've been thinking a lot about our date at the Estee Fair just recently. If I had to guess the two things that you remember most about it, I'd guess the run of luck I had on the Wheel of Fortune. Remember the kid who kept saying, I'd love to see this guy take a beating. And the mask I wore to fool you. That was supposed to be a big joke, but you got mad, and our date damn near went right down the drain.
Maybe if it had, I wouldn't be here now, and that taxi driver would still be alive. On the other hand, maybe nothing at all of importance changes in the future, and I would have been handed the same bullet to eat a week or a month or a year later. Well, we had our chance, and it came up on one of the house numbers. 00, I guess. But I wanted you to know that I think of you, Sarah. For me, there really hasn't been anyone else. And that night was the best night for us. 11. Hello, Johnny, she murmured, and the wind walked softly through the trees that burned and blazed. A red leaf flipped its way across the bright blue sky and landed, unnoticed, in her hair. I'm here. I finally came. Speaking out loud should have also seemed wrong. Speaking to the dead in a graveyard was the act of a crazy person, she would have said once. But now emotion surprised her. Emotion of such force and intensity that it caused her throat to ache and her hands to suddenly clap shut. It was all right to speak to him, maybe. After all, it had been 9 years, and this was the end of it. After this, there would be Walt and the children, and lots of smiles from one of the chairs behind her husband's speaking podium, the endless smiles from the background, and an occasional feature article in the Sunday supplements, if Walt's political career skyrocketed, as he so calmly expected it to do. The future was a little more gray in her hair each year, never going braless because of the sag, becoming more careful about makeup. The future was exercise classes at the YWCA in Bangor, and shopping, and taking Denny to the first grade, and Janice to nursery school. The future was New Year's Eve parties and funny hats, as her life rolled into the science fiction-y decade of the 1980s, and also into a queer and almost unsuspected state, middle age. She saw no county fairs in her future. The first slow, scalding tears began to come. Oh, Johnny, she said. Everything was supposed to be different, wasn't it? It wasn't supposed to end like this. She lowered her head, her throat working painfully, and to no effect. The sobs came anyway, and the bright sunlight broke into prisms of light. The wind, which had seemed so warm and Indian summery, now seemed as chill as February on her wet cheeks. Not fair, she cried into the silence of Bowdoin's and Marston's and Pillsbury's, that dead congregation of listeners who testified to nothing more or less than life is quick and dead is dead. Oh, God, not fair. And that was when the hand touched her neck. 12. And that night was the best night for us. Although there are still times when it's hard for me to believe there ever was such a year as 1970, an upheaval on the campuses, and Nixon was president. No pocket calculators, no home videotape recorders, no Bruce Springsteen or punk rock bands either. And at other times, it seems like that time is only a hand's breadth away, that I can almost touch it. That if I could put my arms around you or touch your cheek or the back of your neck, I could carry you away with me into a different future with no pain or darkness or bitter choices. Well, we all do what we can, and it has to be good enough. And if it isn't good enough, it has to do. I only hope that you will think of me as well as you can, dear Sarah. All my best. And all my love, Johnny. 13. She drew her breath in raggedly, her back straightening, her eyes going wide and round. Johnny. It was gone. Whatever it had been, it was gone. She stood and turned around, and of course there was nothing there. But she could see him standing there, his hands jammed deep into his pockets. That easy, crooked grin on his pleasant rather than handsome face, leaning lanky and at ease against a monument or one of the stone gateposts
or maybe just a tree gone red with fall's dying fire. No big deal, Sarah. You still sniffing that wicked cocaine? Nothing there but Johnny. Somewhere near. Maybe everywhere. We all do what we can, and it has to be good enough. And if it isn't good enough, it has to do. Nothing is ever lost, Sarah. Nothing that can't be found. Same old Johnny, she whispered, and walked out of the cemetery and crossed the road. She paused for a moment, looking back. The warm October wind gusted strongly, and great shades of light and shadow seemed to pass across the world. The trees rustled secretly. Sarah got in her car and drove away.
The Dead Zone was written by Stephen King and read by James Franco. It was recorded at North Hollywood Sound in Los Angeles, California, Wanted Sound and Picture in Toronto, Ontario, and Margarita Mix in Los Angeles, California. Editing and post-production by Mike DeCino for Common Mode. Special thanks to Ronnie Minnis. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producers were Tiffany Frary and Michael Noble. The Dead Zone was directed by Christina Zarafanidis with Travis Tun and produced by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Dead Zone is available as an ebook from Scribner. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Mr. Mercedes by Stephen King, read by Will Patton, and Revival by Stephen King, read by David Morse.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.